Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Stamford, Texas was one of the many small towns in the state to be founded as the result of Texas Central Railroad expansion in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, which made the formation of the town unremarkable, or at least business as usual. It was one of many just like it. However, Stamford stood out in one way. The president of the Texas Central Railroad gave it the same name as his hometown in Connecticut, suggesting, perhaps, that the area, whether it be the land or the folks who lived there, held some sort of special meaning in his heart or in his mind. Stamford initially grew fast. The Swenson Ranch, whose namesake had donated the land for the town to be built, was already there, and other businesses quickly set up shop there. A flour mill, a grocery company, and of course a bank, all arrived within Stamford's first 10 years. A bottling plant, a brick manufacturer, cotton producers, and clothing makers came in within the town's first half century. And no city or town in Texas would be complete without the discovery of oil, which was unearthed in Stamford in 1935, boosting the economy, of course. Regardless of Stamford's well-established industry and economy, the town's population never really boomed, and its downtown's early 20th century architecture is as idyllic and quintessentially Texas as a small town here can get. Stamford is 40 miles due north of Abilene, and due at least in part to its proximity to the fairly large city, crime certainly wasn't unheard of there. And by the early 1980s, like virtually every other city or town in the state of Texas, violent crime was up. But it was still considerably behind states such as California in that regard. In 1988, though, the small town of Stamford was hit with a crime that neither the city's police nor the county sheriff's office were used to. A heinous crime against one of their children. In the early 80s, Candy and Stan Clayton moved their family to Stamford, Texas from San Diego, California, in search of a quieter and safer life for their children, two boys and a girl. The Claytons figured the small, picturesque town was the perfect place to raise their kids. It was far enough away from high crime cities, and better still, Stamford seemed like a different world from San Diego's violent crime and seemingly escalating child abductions. Stan landed a job as a manager of a sewing company, and the family lived normal and peaceful lives in friendly Stamford. It certainly seemed like they'd made the right decision moving there. By 1988, Candy and Stan's blonde-haired and brown-eyed daughter, Courtney Lynn, was 7 years old and in second grade. She'd grown into a thriving, adventurous, happy, and vibrant child. Courtney, who seemed like a natural for rural, small-town life, could constantly be seen getting around on her bicycle or playing baseball, and she already had good taste in music, always opting for 1950s and 60s rock and roll. Courtney was intelligent beyond her age, and she wasn't bashful. Her father Stan later commented to a reporter that she was outgoing and friendly to everyone she came in contact with, telling them that Courtney was incredibly gabby. She liked to talk. Courtney was so friendly, so talkative in fact, that she had to be specifically warned about talking to strangers. On the evening of Friday, September 2, 1988, a significant chunk of the population of Stamford had deserted their town, traveling 80 miles southeast to Eastland to watch the Stamford High School football team, the Bulldogs, face off against Eastland's Mavericks. The Claytons, however, stayed behind. Not long before dark that evening, Courtney arrived home from riding around on her bike and began begging her father to let her walk a half block to the convenience store to get a soda. It wasn't unusual at all for Courtney or her two older brothers to visit the store for a Coke or a snack. In fact, everyone who worked there knew the children, and though Stan wouldn't budge at first, he finally relented. She wanted to buy a soft drink. She kept bugging me. So I finally said, "Okay, go," Stan Clayton later told a reporter. He gave his daughter 50 cents and watched her cross the street. It was the biggest danger of letting Courtney go, he thought. "I could see her go to cross the street," Stan later said. "The store was kind of offset, so I couldn't see her go into the store." Courtney did make it into the store. And at 8:47 p.m., now dark, she placed her soda on the counter for the clerk to ring up. She was a few cents shy of the total, and the man in line behind Courtney offered to pay the remainder. But since she was at the convenience store on an almost daily basis, and the clerk knew he could trust her, he told the man not to worry about it. He said that Courtney was good for it, and could bring back what she owed later. After young Courtney left the store, conflicting accounts arose. One possible witness, a motorist, said they saw Courtney walking down the street toward her home at 8:53 p.m. But Courtney's brother arrived at the convenience store at 8:55 p.m. His path almost undoubtedly would have had to cross his sister's had she begun the trek home. He didn't pass her, though, and when he arrived at the store, Courtney was nowhere to be found. According to her family, the plan was for Courtney to go to the store, buy a drink, and wait there for her brother to arrive and walk her back home, which calls the motorist's sighting of Courtney into question. And since her soda was found sitting on the bumper of the convenience store clerk's pickup truck, it's likely she had indeed been waiting for her brother there, never having left the property to head back home. The Claytons wasted no time reporting Courtney's disappearance to the Stamford Police Department. An immediate search for the 4-foot-tall, 55-pound girl, last seen wearing maroon terry cloth shorts, blue sneakers, and a white t-shirt with balloon print, the first of many searches, lasted through the night and into the daylight hours of Saturday, September 3rd, 1988. Friends of Courtney's were called and their houses visited in hopes the young girl had simply gone to see one of them. Streets, areas behind businesses and their dumpsters, and wooded areas were combed through, but there was no sign of Courtney. The only clue seemed to be the soda she'd left behind on the convenience store clerk's pickup truck bumper, at least at that point. It was obvious to her parents that Courtney did not run away, and police agreed. There was absolutely no evidence to support such a theory. Law enforcement could find no signs that Courtney left the parking lot and theorized quickly that she had been abducted from there, taken in a motor vehicle. Stamford sits on the border of two counties, and it didn't take long for a large group of search volunteers from both Haskell and Jones counties to join the efforts. Residents organized search parties in both rural areas and in town, going door to door seeking information and passing out posters featuring Courtney's description and photo. Local businesses, too, displayed the posters in their windows, and game wardens from the six surrounding counties also began searching by both land and air. On Tuesday, September 6th, 1988, the FBI joined the search. Tips had been coming in, and they continued to, but most didn't provide substantive information. That is, until a particular witness came along. If the unthinkable happens, are you prepared? Insurance companies these days often refuse coverage for some of the unexpected costs of medical emergencies, leaving you holding an outrageous bill that you most likely weren't prepared for. There is a way, though, to safeguard your health and protect your finances from such an event with an AirMed Care Network membership. For as low as $65 per year, an AirMed Care Network membership can provide you or a family member with emergency medical transport to the nearest appropriate hospital with no out-of-pocket expenses. Members never pay a dime to be transported by an AirMed Care Network provider. They are the largest group of emergent transport providers in the world. Join the 3 million AirMed Care Network members and secure your peace of mind today. I recently joined, and the peace of mind is real. Right now, AirMed Care Network is offering Gone Cold listeners a $10 Visa gift card with a one-year membership. Just visit airmedcarenetwork.com/Texas and use offer code Texas. Again, visit airmedcarenetwork.com/Texas, use offer code Texas, and get a $10 Visa gift card when you sign up for a one-year membership. Several days into the search for missing 7-year-old Courtney Clayton, after no good information was obtained and no trace of the girl could be found, Jones County Sheriff Mike Middleton identified a witness, and it became clear that the convenience store clerk wasn't the last person to see Courtney. This witness had been just across the alley next to the store that night to pick up her husband at an apartment there, and remembered seeing Courtney fooling around in the convenience store's parking lot. Next to the clerk's pickup truck, a late model car was parked, with its door open, she recalled. A man was leaning against the building near the car, and she noticed another man sitting in the car, the interior of which was white, and as she drove past, she said, the man standing against the building turned his head as if to hide his face. Some of the details of her account emerged as the witness underwent hypnosis, though it is unclear exactly which. Regardless, police were able to develop a composite sketch of one of the men through the witness's recollections while she was under hypnosis, and the drawing of the man was released in newspapers and on posters which hung in local businesses. Unfortunately, it provided nothing, nor did the several appearances that Courtney's parents, Candy and Stan, made on various television shows to discuss their missing daughter. Candy and Stan didn't know who would or could do such a thing. They were baffled by Courtney's disappearance. "We don't have any enemies or know anyone who would want to do this," Stan Clayton told the press, perhaps unable to grasp the dismal notion that monsters walked among him. He went on, "We have never had any problems with anyone, nothing to suspect, but we are hoping through newspapers and television something will come." Nearly 7 long, excruciating months would pass before any sign of Courtney was found. And the next discovery was the worst possible one. Moran, Texas, population just shy of 300, is a town in Shackelford County, a little over 50 miles southeast of Stamford. On Sunday, March 26, 1989, Easter, in a remote rural grassland 10 miles west of Moran, not far from Highway 283, and off a road rarely traveled, hunters discovered a small skull with its jawbone missing. Though the hunters were in Shackelford County, they brought the skull to the sheriff's office in neighboring Callahan County after some confusion as to which county the location of the skull was in. It was probably 10 miles north of Baird and Interstate I-20, and south of Albany, about 12 miles. Jones County Sheriff Mike Middleton later explained to the press, "Kind of out in the middle of nowhere," he added. Texas Rangers recovered the rest of the skeleton, scattered across about 200 yards of the grassland, an arm bone, leg bones, and rib bones. A few days later, police and volunteers inspected the field closely for anything that might help shed light on the identity of the skeletal remains. But there was nothing there. No clothing was found, nor anything else that belonged to the body. They knew the bones belonged to a child or a very small adult, but it wasn't clear to them at that time if they were male or female. For testing, the remains first went to Dallas, to the Southwest Institute of Forensic Science, including hair samples that had been found close to them. Police suspected that there was a good chance the bones belonged to 7-year-old Courtney Clayton, and when they sent the remains for testing, they sent hair samples of Courtney's taken from barrettes and clothing of hers. They did tell me the skull was a child's skull, and that the bones were the size and weight, and possibly the age category of Courtney, Stan Clayton, the girl's father, told the press, adding, "We're not giving up hope, but there hasn't been another child missing in this area. You put all the things together, and it looks like it might be her. I guess this is a very low point right now. We've tried to keep our hopes high, but we've always expected something like this. We're still praying it will be something else." The remains were subsequently sent to the anthropology department of the University of North Texas in Denton after identification in Dallas failed. DNA testing wasn't yet available to investigators whose agencies were working Courtney's case, and even if they were, the technology was in its infancy, so it's possible it wouldn't have been much help. On Saturday, April 8, 1989, after matching hair found near the bones to hair obtained from Courtney's hairbrush with computer imaging tech, and after utilizing a facial overlay technique, placing photos of Courtney's face over the skull, law enforcement announced that they'd identified the remains as Courtney Clayton's. Even with this revelation, the Claytons were skeptical at first. They didn't want to believe their daughter, their baby girl, was dead. "They said it's her," Candy Clayton told a reporter, but went on, "I won't believe it until I see the tape that shows me it's her. I had a feeling all along it was her. I just didn't want to believe it." Though far from the general area where Courtney's remains were found, a pair of maroon shorts and a white t-shirt with balloons were close enough, Sheriff Middleton said, that it was likely the wind and rains carried the clothing, Courtney's clothing, to where the items were finally discovered. Texas Ranger Calvin Cox didn't mince words. "Her death has been ruled as a violent homicide," he said. Over 500 people attended the memorial service for Courtney Clayton, held at the First Baptist Church in Stamford on Wednesday, April 19, 1989, to mourn the tragic and senseless death of the 7-year-old who was once so full of life. Even with the help of trained search dogs around the area where Courtney was found, the police came up empty-handed. But the top law official of the county where Courtney's remains were found, Sheriff Ben Riley, insisted that he would not give up, and even after a month, in May of 89, Sheriff Riley said they were searching the area almost daily. He told the press that they had indeed found more clues, but would not divulge any further details, saying only, "Some evidence will be taken to an Austin lab by Texas Rangers. We're getting closer and closer to a solution all the time. We have searched the entire area where her remains were found, as well as bar ditches from here to Stamford. It is a very intense investigation. We have gotten lucky and found a few things that may fit in." Sheriff Riley's optimism was admirable, but would eventually prove to be baseless, even with three separate agencies investigating Courtney's case, his own, the Texas Rangers, and the Jones County Sheriff's Office. Jones County Sheriff Mike Middleton knew how important solving Courtney's case was to her family and to the community. I'd like to see somebody charged with it. If they knew somebody was behind bars for this, it would make a lot of difference for them and for us, he told the press. Sheriff Middleton was also aware of his small department's lack of experience and resources. Nothing like this has ever occurred, he said, adding, We just never had kids go missing. That was big city stuff. We were just country boys. But not long after Courtney disappeared, long before her remains were found, Sheriff Middleton's department was rocked by another terrible discovery in their county. A crime that, when the details came to light, was as heinous and as evil as can be imagined. On the morning of Friday, November 11th, 1988, in a pasture in rural Jones County, two men quail hunting came upon items that didn't belong in the natural setting. Children's clothing, a blanket, a Raggedy Ann doll, a bottle of lotion, and paper towels. It was a strange sight that led the men's minds to imagine that an unspeakable and depraved event had occurred at this scene, particularly since some of the items appeared to have been splattered with blood, and because the two men were well aware that a 7-year-old girl, Courtney Clayton, had gone missing a little over a month before. They called law enforcement, and Jones County Sheriff's Office deputies wasted little time making their way to the pasture to perform a search. Nearby, where the items were found, laid the body of a 7-year-old girl, but it wasn't Courtney Clayton. It was another little girl who had just been reported missing hours before, April Murray Wilson. April, who lived with her single mother in Merkel, Texas, had been sent to her mother's cousin's home so that her cousin could watch April while she went to work the night before her body was discovered. After she begged her mother, Maggie Howlett, to stay the night there, she finally agreed. Maggie was going to be working late anyway, she figured. Maggie's cousin's roommate, a 21-year-old bartender and laborer named Gary Dean Miller, arrived at the house at about 1:30 a.m., after working late and socializing a bit after. Miller was tequila drunk when he arrived home and woke up 7-year-old April, asking her if she'd like to go for a ride with him. She went, and at some point, Miller stopped the truck. He told authorities upon his confession, which wasn't long after, that April hugged him because he looked depressed, and he began fondling her. The details of what happened next, the specifics of the hell that Miller inflicted upon this child, I do not possess the emotional fortitude to write, let alone narrate. But to simplify, Miller subsequently removed April from the vehicle, a truck, and placed her on the tailgate, where he sexually assaulted the child in nightmarish ways, April crying the entire time, he said, before choking and bludgeoning her to death to hide his inhuman depravity and evil. Miller dragged April's lifeless body through the brush and cacti using coat hangers, he confessed, and returned to the home where he collected the girl's belongings. But he couldn't remember exactly where he'd left April. He gave up looking and discarded the belongings where they were found later that morning. Though Miller's defense at trial attempted a not guilty plea by reason of insanity, the medical and psychiatric expert presented by the state determined that the assault and murder of April was meticulous, as were his attempts at covering his tracks, as he supported Maggie Howlett and her search efforts for her daughter. The expert said that the assault and murder was as brutal as he had ever seen in a child. Miller was sentenced to death, and later, in 2000, the execution was carried out. Gary Dean Miller, anyway, undoubtedly came upon the radar of police as a possible suspect in Courtney Clayton's abduction and murder. But ultimately, investigators determined that the two crimes were not related. Miller wasn't the only possibility to come up in the investigation of Courtney's slaying. Multiple attempted abductions had taken place in neighboring or nearby counties, and police wondered if any were connected. About 130 miles north of Stamford, in Childress, Texas, a man attempted to kidnap a 7-year-old girl in May of 1988. And though the sheriff there felt he knew who the failed perpetrator was, based partially on the description given by the child, they didn't have proof. And the following October, again in Childress, a man tried to snatch a 7-year-old boy, but was thwarted when the boy's dog attacked him, shredding pieces of his coat, which were left behind on the scene. Both Childress attempted abductions, police thought, based on descriptions given, were performed by the same man. On Tuesday, August 29, 1989, 36 miles north of Stamford, in Knox City, a man pulled up beside a girl walking home from school, aged 9, and told her he'd been sent to pick her up and take her home. The girl, fortunately, didn't buy the predator's line. Possible suspects, too, emerged a year after Courtney's disappearance in Baird, about 57 miles southeast of Stamford, when two Albany, Texas men were arrested and charged with attempted enticement of a minor there. Two men, Lucio Saceda and Martin Martinez, attempted to lure two brothers, ages 5 and 10, into their vehicle, but the boys ran into their home and told their father, who pursued the men as they fled. He was able to provide police with a description of the vehicle and, presumably, a license plate number. And the men, luckily, were quickly apprehended in Albany by Shackelford County Sheriff Ben Riley after a Be on the Lookout was issued over police bands in the area and surrounding areas. Just a couple days after Saceda and Martinez were taken into custody, on September 7, 1989, back in Stamford, a man in a ski mask approached a 10-year-old girl, attempting to lure her into his pickup truck. Obviously, investigators working Courtney Clayton's case had no shortage of possibilities, but in the end, nothing came from any of them. Courtney's killer remains elusive to justice, and her case unsolved. In an interview in 2007, Courtney's mother, Candy, explained the struggle of living in a small town like Stamford and wondering if, or perhaps feeling that, Courtney's killer is someone who lives there, someone they've crossed paths with at the grocery store or while filling up their gas tank at the service station. I have always felt that somebody here in town knows something, even if they don't know they know it, she said. In 2012, Courtney's father, Stan, attempted to voice the anguish he and his family felt as a result of their loss, the hole that hasn't grown smaller with time, particularly due to the lack of answers the Claytons have. We still hurt. We're still mad. Sometimes we're angry because someone robbed us out of that pleasure of having her all that time. They cheated us out of the graduation, marriage, and possibly grandchildren from her, he said, adding, people will tell you, I know what you're going through, but unless you've been there, done that, you may think you know what we're going through, but you really don't. Stan always expected his little girl to walk back through the door someday, hoping for something kind of like Elizabeth Smart, as he puts it. Maybe still in denial that the remains found in March of 1989 were Courtney's. But he'd been long aware of the ill hand fate had dealt his family. We cannot seem to get out of our minds that the reason we left San Diego was because of child abductions and violence. We moved to Texas to get away from violence and fear of things like this, Stan said back in September of 1988, days after Courtney vanished. Thank you. If you have any information on the murder of Courtney Clayton, please call either the Jones County Sheriff's Office at 325-823-4607, the Texas Rangers through their website dps.texas.gov/coldcase, or by calling the Department of Public Safety's hotline at 800-346-3243, or by calling the Crime Stoppers hotline at 800-252-8477, where you can remain completely anonymous. The Abilene Reporter News, the Albany News, the Port Arthur News, the Galveston Daily News, the Seymour Baylor County Banner, the El Paso Times, the Tyler Courier Times, the Odessa American, the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, ClarkProsecutor.org, KTXS Television, and BigCountryHomepage.com were used as sources for this episode. You can support Gone Cold Podcast, Texas True Crime, at patreon.com/GoneColdPodcast. There you'll find several donation levels to choose from, all with different thank you perks, including stickers and t-shirts, and all levels come with ad-free listening. We appreciate everyone's new and continued support. We wouldn't be able to do what we do without the help we receive from y'all, so thank you. And thanks for listening, y'all.